On this week's 51%, we speak with sports journalist Jane McManus about the history of women's sports and her new book, The Fast Track, Inside the Surging Business of Women's Sports.
If you're trying to disincentivize someone from watching women's sports, those days are over. Like, people want to watch and crowds are showing up, and I think it's time.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. This month, we're bringing you a series of episodes on women's history for Women's History Month. But it's also college basketball season, and the women's NCAA tournament is just around the corner. Depending on when you're tuning in, it may have already started. So last year, the final between the University of South Carolina and the University of Iowa drew more viewers than even the men's championship final. And at the time, it was the most watched basketball game, college or professional, since 2019. Stars like Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, Paige Beckers, Megan Rapinoe, Coco Gauff, and Simone Biles are fueling a new passion for women's sports. Our guest today would argue that passion isn't new, but the spotlight does come with lots of opportunity. Jane McManus is a sports journalist and analyst who spent nearly 10 years covering the NFL for ESPN. Her work has also appeared on ESPNW, Good Morning America, CNN, and NPR. She was the founding executive director of the Center for Sports Media at Seton Hall University and has taught at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, Michigan State University, Marist University, and now NYU. Her new book, The Fast Track, takes a look at the business behind women's sports, why they've been held back for so long, and why she feels it stands to make a lot of money. See, McManus says the idea that people simply aren't as interested in women's sports as they are men's leagues is simply a myth, and that America's fascination with women athletes goes further back than the passage of Title IX in the early 1970s. Nowadays, she says our interest in women's sports is becoming harder for industry leaders to ignore, even if they still don't fully understand the scope of it.
We live in a capitalist society, and that is the metric by which people judge success or failure. And I think there's been a lot of kind of assumed narratives around women's sports over the years about their relative success, but not a lot of actual metric making. So what I mean by that is actually looking at the numbers and really assessing, like, what is the market for women's sports? And, you know, as I was doing the research for this book, you know, one of the women I interviewed said, you know, we still don't know what the total addressable market is here. And that's a basic number for so many areas. And yet it hadn't even been discerned for women's sports. And I just think that's a real show of kind of neglect of women's sports as a subject and as a market. Mm-hmm. And as somebody who covered sports for, you know, 25 years now, mostly the NFL, but also a lot of women's sports, and as a columnist for ESPNW, you know, I kind of saw firsthand that neglect. And so I kind of, in this moment of real optimism, I just felt like it was important to also note that the reason this hasn't arrived a little sooner is the neglect.
Just for those who don't know, you know, including myself, what does total addressable market mean?
Well, it's like, what is the ceiling here? You think about a stadium and it has a certain number of seats in it. And how many of those seats will be filled by a specific event? So you put an NFL game in there, you put a women's basketball game in there, you put a poker match in there, you put a chess game in there. Like, you can think about all of the different things that you might put in and think how many people would show up. And that's basically what total addressable market is in, you know, in some way. There are ways of looking at it. You know, I look at jersey sales, for example. In 2019, for the Women's World Cup, there were a certain number of official World Cup jerseys for the women's team that were manufactured and sold, and they sold out really quickly. And the storyline was, hey, isn't this a great story? Like, all of these jerseys have sold out. But the fact is, like, once they're sold, you really can't sell any more of them. So then how many more jerseys would be sold if there were more in stock? And so those are numbers that aren't being counted because the jerseys haven't been made. And that's actually the story for women's sports as well, in some ways, kind of lowballing what that market might be. So not understanding how many people might buy jerseys leaves a lot of money on the table if you get that number wrong. And I think that's kind of been something where women's sports has suffered a little bit as well, is that the people making decisions about how many jerseys to make are lowballing the interest.
Kind of taking a look at how we got here, where does, I guess, the history of professional women's sports start, at least in your view?
Well, so here's the deal. Women have always played sports, and for a lot of time, they've played sports at a quasi-professional level. I mean, you obviously have a league of their own and the storytelling around like softball during World War II. But you know, there was a swimmer named Gertrude Ederle in the 1920s who swam the English Channel. And she was such a popular figure that there was a ticker tape parade up Broadway to celebrate her accomplishment. And I don't think that people understand that, like, the women who were able to do things like Babe Didrikson, and you know, they had large followings. And there was a women's soccer league that played during World War II in the UK, and they could get 50,000 fans to a game, and became so popular that when the war ended, the UK soccer governing body said that women could not play on their fields anymore. And what that meant was that any field that had stands that could hold, you know, a crowd, they were off limits to women. And so, you know, there have been a lot of ways that women have kind of been pushed out of the space rather than included in it completely. You know, you go back to the late 1800s, there was a German doctor who said that, you know, if women play sports, they'll damage their reproductive organs. And so, you know, the idea of women, well, what is it to be a woman? Well, to be a woman at that time was to have children, to be part of a family. And so if you were doing anything that would impair your ability to do what your actual purpose was as a woman, then that was, you know, completely off limits to you. And that's why we had these bans on women running marathons. You know, women couldn't run in the Boston Marathon until the 1969, because right, there was this assumption that women shouldn't be able to do that because it would be damaging to them. Women's running was actually something that, you know, for a long time, that kind of women were dissuaded from doing distance running. And of course, you know, now we know that women, the endurance sports are actually something that women are really good at, particularly as they get older, and can even be better than men. Some of these endurance, these, you know, 100-mile races through the desert, so women can win those outright against male competitors as well. So, you know, again, we don't have a very good understanding of the women's bodies and what they're capable of in sports, just because it hasn't really been studied, because so long, you know, what we expect of women in a social setting has been primary to what women can do as athletes.
Yeah, you know, when you say that, it just makes me think about, you know, the different arguments people throw up there for their opposition to transgender women in women's sports, you know, that it puts them at an unfair advantage biologically or whatever. And you know what you just said, it just seems like it pokes a hole in that, considering we don't even know the full extent of what women are capable of. And you know, you've got cis women beating cis men in some categories.
You know, that's a great point. And there are so many places where we can, men and women can play together, where inclusive play is something that can take place. Like, you know, when, before you're the age of 12, whatever biological differences there are, they're not really there yet in enough of a way to make it so that boys and girls can't play together, or, you know, everybody who wants to play can't be involved in a soccer game. I think, you know, this idea also that everything has to be segregated, you know, according to gender or sex, in some way, is does us a disservice from being able to play together and to cooperate when we're playing and be on the same teams and work together. And those are really important values that sports can give you as well. And so some of this conversation, I think, around, well, what category are you being sorted into? Are you a boy or are you a girl? You know, there are lots of ways to sort people. And in boxing, they do it by weight category. And, you know, you can do it by height, you can do it by skill level. Like, there are lots of different ways to sort people for quote unquote fairness. And it's not always, you know, based on what was on your birth certificate when you were born.
Looking through the history of women's sports, are there some key players or games that you feel everyone should remember and know about?
That's a great question. Well, I mean, I think 1996, if you're an American, was a great year for a lot of women's teams in the Olympics. The American women took home gold in gymnastics, basketball, and soccer. I think I'm blanking on the fourth, but I'm just saying like that women's team was particularly strong. And that's because of Title IX. That was the kind of the apex year for Title IX, because in this country, of course, in 1972, Title IX was passed, and that created a lot more opportunities for women and girls to play sports. And that first generation kind of matriculated that at the end of the 90s. And so you see this great wave of women in America who were competing internationally at such a high level and bringing home so much gold. And that's really because the rest of the world hadn't really caught up. You didn't have those same waves emerging in England or in, Central America or in any other parts of the world the same way that you did because of a policy decision made in the United States. And now I think what's so different is the rest of the world is catching up. And, particularly in Western Europe, but in a lot of other places too, you find, women's teams can be very strong and very, and women's leagues also kind of given American leagues a run for the money. The NWSL, the Women's Soccer League here in the United States, is not just for American women or in America, but it's competing internationally with a Premier League based league in the UK as well for women, and with other leagues across the world that are popping up.
How exactly is the industry different today than it was back then in a way that's helping to nourish this interest and popularity and sort of allowing it to have the spotlight now?
Yeah, well, I think honestly why today is a little bit different is that you have women who've played sports who are now reinvesting back in sports. And so you have the big names like Serena Williams and Sabrina Ionescu and Mia Hamm and Julie Foudy and all of these great women that are kind of iconic athletes are reinvesting in peer leagues and teams. And so this is a way of kind of conveying a sense of importance now. And that's attracting eyeballs and it's attracting more money. And you do have a sense of like, well, the ceiling for this is a lot higher. I think the original piece of this, why it's different now, is social media. You have somebody like an athlete like Megan Rapinoe, who famously played soccer for those World Cup winning teams and pink hair and end zone antics and all of this. Well, when she in the mid 2010s has 2 million followers on Instagram, it's impossible to say people don't care about women's sports, I think, which was a very convenient argument to make, say 20 years ago. But it's impossible to make when you have women who have these large followings on social media. And so when you have an athlete who's a quote unquote influencer, and influencers were being sought after so that they could help promote products and tell stories around brands, then obviously there's a use there for those athletes that have amassed these large audiences. And I think that's kind of where things changed, was all of a sudden brands were like, well, why would we discount Megan Rapinoe when we're looking at other people who've done far fewer remarkable things than she has? Also, the ratings around women's soccer were incredible. And so these kinds of numbers start telling the story of why this moment is different, because it's no longer something that you can discount or look away from.
So branding's a big opportunity and help right now. I guess overall, what do you view as some of the key opportunities here that the industry should be taking advantage of?
Well, I think you're starting to see them develop now. So women don't necessarily watch sports the same way that men do. Not all women anyway. It's like we're not a monolith, right? No one's a monolith. So men's sports have been watched in a way that's kind of particular and well understood, and we have a real roadmap for that. But when it comes to women's sports, I think there are some differences. And rather than actually explore what those differences are and then try to meet the market where it was, instead it was just ignored. And well, it's hard to change up our entire system that we already have. We're very comfortable with it. Why should we change it up for these other sports? We don't know if they're going to be popular. But it turns out that women's sports can be, are like, there are some things that are really successful in women's sports. And one of these things is big events and big event coverage. So I think of the Olympics and World Cup. It's, clear that men and women love watching these, women compete in these big events. And something that was really impactful for me, because I went to high school in Lincoln, Nebraska, was Volleyball Day, which was 2 years ago when University of Nebraska Lincoln had four volleyball teams play at Memorial Stadium. And Memorial Stadium is where the Cornhuskers play football. And, when I was growing up, Downtown Lincoln, Nebraska was transformed on Saturdays. It was a sea of red as people were pouring into the stadium and making it the third largest city in Nebraska on game days. Like, so that is my childhood. And then here you have these four volleyball teams. So they decide they're going to have it. They start selling tickets and it sells out. So then they reconfigure the floor, because imagine like a volleyball court takes up less space than a football field. And so they were able to kind of reconfigure it, sell more tickets. And when Volleyball Day finally arrived, it broke the attendance records for Memorial Stadium. And so this is the kind of thing. Now, so Nebraska volleyball plays in a stadium that holds, you know, maybe 9,000 people, 8,000 people. Are that many people going to show up every single time to watch volleyball? Well, maybe. I mean, I guess you don't know, because you don't have a venue that's large enough that's there to ask to answer that question. But this kind of event coverage and packing it and having it be like, you know, a big deal and everybody gets tickets for it, it's like, that's something that's super successful as a model when it comes to women's sports. I think we're seeing it now with the Final Four as well. I was just looking for tickets and for the women's tournament. And, you know, like the cheapest one is $236 right now. And those are the resale, you know, so you're kind of, you know, this now is like starting to emerge, I think, as more of a trend, particularly in women's sports, but it's something that also happens in men's. But here you could really be creative about how are we going to, okay, so now we know something about the way people like to watch and consume women's sports. How can we engage that audience in that way? Same things with, you know, branding and using women as to sell products or to engage with brands, because, you know, fans of women's sports are, they've noticed this a little bit more. They're apparently, you know, there's been now they're starting to do some research on this. And, you know, if you're a fan of a woman who plays sports and they are engaging with a brand, you're much more likely to think, have positive associations with that brand because of that engagement. So in some ways, you know, women can be more effective when it comes to being a spokesperson than we've thought of men's athletes. And those have been very successful in the past as well.
Do we see people following teams or are mostly individual players?
Yeah, that's a great question. I couldn't tell you the answer to that, to be frank. Well, particularly with like college teams, it's hard to hire college teams necessarily.
Yeah, yeah.
And we do have NIL, so name, image, and likeness. So you can hire individual athletes even at the college level. And I think there are some athletes, women who play, who are getting, you know, having a lot of success with name, image, and likeness deals. But I do think you're seeing like, you know, the WNBA is now, and the NWSL both just signed new broadcast deals, which are kind of multi-platform and, you know, that are higher than they've ever signed in the past. So that sort of thing is starting to come to leagues and to individuals.
Well, I wanted to ask, you know, about the pay gap. Over the years, I've read a lot of reports about the pay gap in women's sports compared to men's sports and how, you know, women's teams often get lesser equipment and facilities than men do. Do you think we're going to see that change with this new spotlight, or are there other kinds of hurdles out there still for athletes?
Yeah, so salaries at the league level, so if you're talking about the WNBA or National Women's Soccer League, those are a function of revenue. So the way that it works in sports is that all the money that come in from tickets, from the broadcast deals, and from jersey, that goes into a pile. And then owners usually take half the pile and players take the other half of the pile. It depends on the collective bargaining agreement. Most, you know, all of these leagues, the players are unionized, so they are represented and their deals are collectively bargained. So you can only have salaries that are as high as your revenue allows them to be. And so really what needs to happen is that revenue levels need to go up, which they are. And then once that happens, you're going to have owners incentivized to further professionalize the settings, the arenas, et cetera. I think what we're seeing is that the buy-in for a team now at the WNBA or the NWSL is much higher than it used to be. Every single new franchise is having to pay a much higher amount in order to get in. 200 million, you know, when maybe 10 years ago, it would have been 10 million. So like really just exponentially getting bigger and bigger. And the reason for that is that the expectation of return on their investment is much higher. And for that reason for that is that like, you're just looking at potentially more and more coming in, you know, bigger deals when it comes to broadcast, more fans when it comes to seating, And then also the partnerships, the brand partnerships and things like this, that money is all going way up. So unfortunately, like those athlete salaries, they're kind of the last to feel that because that's all a function of the revenue as it's collectively bargained. So for women, Wasserman Collective, Wasserman is an agency which represents a lot of athletes, and they have an agency, part of their agency is specifically devoted to women. And what they've done is they've released some numbers saying that most women who play professional sports, 82% of their annual income comes from endorsements, not their salary. And it's almost flip, if you play men's sports. And the reason for that is that, women just have to rely more on those endorsements because the salaries are so low. But those numbers are going up, and you could use women's professional tennis as a model. The salaries for women who play professional tennis, particularly at a high level, can reach stratospheric heights, but they've also had a 50-year head start on some of these other leagues that are now up and coming.
Well, Jane, thanks so much for taking the time. What do you hope people most take away from the fast track?
Just that there are a lot of economics is a science, but it isn't a science like chemistry. There's a lot of psychology involved in it as well. And I just think, kind of examining the why of something and really look and saying, when you hear, oh, nobody watches women's sports, well, what are people really telling you when they say that? And I think, if you're trying to disincentivize someone from watching women's sports, those days are over. Like, people want to watch, and crowds are showing up, and I think it's time.
I wanted to ask too. I mean, at the time we're chatting, it's before Selection Sunday, so the women's NCAA tournament hasn't started yet. What are some of the top things you're keeping an eye on for this year?
Every year is different. You have these two incredible players last year in Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese, and they kind of revolutionized the sport. And it's funny because I was looking for tickets this morning. There were a lot of people who were like, oh, when Angel and Caitlin leave, then this interest in the women's game is going to go down. And I'll tell you right now, like, we're a month out, and I'm looking, and it's sold out, and those seats are going up on the secondary ticket market. And so I would just be looking for, how well do those games do? Do we see a drop off? Is the interest level the same? Is it going up? It kind of feels like a lot of people are saying Caitlin Clark was the catalyst for this. And what I say is Caitlin Clark is the beneficiary of a lot of the work that's been done. She's not the catalyst, but let's see what's next. Let's see what she brings about.
Jane McManus is a longtime sports journalist and an instructor at NYU's Preston Robert Tisch Institute for Global Sport. Her new book is The Fast Track, Inside the Surging Business of Women's Sports. It's out now through Temple University Press. The best bobsled and skeleton athletes in the world are in upstate New York right now. The Olympic Village of Lake Placid is hosting world championship races for the two sliding sports. North Country Public Radio's Emily Russell reports.
Blink and you might just miss it. Bobsledding is a sport that happens fast, especially when you're watching in person. I'm at the starting line of the women's monobob race, an event that features one athlete per bobsled. Four-time Olympian Alana Myers-Taylor steps up to the starting line. She's in a navy bodysuit and a black helmet that says USA on the top. Myers-Taylor pulls down her helmet's visor, grabs onto the back of the bobsled, and begins to push. She sprints down the ice, and seconds later, she's tucking her body tightly into the bobsled. And then she's gone, out of sight around the first curve of the track. A bunch of athletes are gathered up here by the starting line, including Charlotte Ross. She competes for Team Canada. I ask her what it's like to go barreling down the track.
It feels like you're in a bus with no seatbelt that's just been rolled off the side of a mountain.
Ross is from Ottawa. She's what's known as a brakeman. So in the two-person bobsled race, Ross sits in the back with her head tucked down and her hands on the brakes.
You can't see anything. You're going anywhere from 130 to 150 kilometers per hour. It's terrifying, but the adrenaline is unmatched.
More than 300 athletes from nearly 40 countries are here in Lake Placid. The World Championship event features both bobsled and skeleton races. That's the sport where athletes lie headfirst on a flat, open sled with no brakes. Lisa Tucker is in town watching her stepson, Nick Tucker, who's a skeleton racer reaching speeds of up to 80 miles an hour.
We bought him his first helmet. That was about the best we could do.
Lisa and her husband, Avery, travel up to Lake Placid from Maryland every time Tucker races here.
He is very committed to what he's doing. And, you know, we kind of live vicariously, I guess, through him now.
Like many athletes here, their son wasn't always a professional slider. He played football in college. Alana Myers-Taylor, the bobsledder at the start of the story, she played professional softball. And Keisha Love, who's up next in the monobob event, was a Division I track star in college. She was a top-tier sprinter. Sprinting is a big part of this sport, but so is the strength needed to push the 300-pound sled. That's where Maggie McCrudden comes in. She's the food and nutrition dietitian at the Lake Placid Olympic and Paralympic Training Center.
These athletes are primarily muscle, so they need a lot of quick energy to get that sled to full speed.
McCrudden says eating the right food at the right time during events like this can make a big difference.
When they work hard, they're burning a lot of calories, and we need to replenish that and make sure that after their races, they're getting enough protein and carbs and fat to get ready for that next race that's coming up pretty soon.
In women's monobob, the athletes race down the track four times over 2 days. Those times are added up, and the athlete with the lowest total time wins.
Now it's only a tenth of a second. Monobob racing's going to be close. Here she comes.
After her second run, American Keisha Love is sitting in first place. In an interview with the International Bobsleigh and Skeleton Federation, Love says she wasn't expecting to be in the top spot, especially considering how tough the track is in Lake Placid.
Yeah, it's extremely challenging, but for me, it's a track I learned on. So I have this like love-hate relationship with it. It's one of the hardest tracks in the world, which I love the taboo behind that.
Love's fourth and final run down the track is her fastest. She wins a gold medal, and her teammate, Alana Myers-Taylor, takes bronze.
The leader from the very first heat held her nerve and kept up her speed.
As Love crosses the finish line, she throws her arms up in the air, officially a world champion. In Lake Placid, I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
You've been listening to 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells in little girl dreams. They said, oh, I want a big life, not a house I could have been like. Where are you taking me? Where are you taking me?